you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and all the things.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who's made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently making a third, Best Friends Forever, and I'm a producer's rep, and I also do other things in life. I like watching Frasier. All right, now you.
You and Frasier. This week, we welcome actor, writer, and director Lena Headey on the show to talk about directing her first feature film, The Trap, about a woman who has cut herself off from the world but is slowly brought back to the world through a friendship with a troubled young man. Thanks to Eric Toms for going to Austin to get this interview. We'll hear from Eric in a little bit. But after that, we play another round of The Game. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I always want to prepare what to say during this segment, and all things feel inappropriate. It's like, you talk about your kids, I feel self-indulgent. You talk about how my dad's ashes are like in the kitchen right now, that feels a little too personal. If I talk about the fact that like we're at the end of House of the Fall of Usher, Fall of the House of Usher, that might be something that's safe. Is that a safe topic? Do you watch it right now? Are you watching it?
You managed to talk about all of the things, so that's nice.
The way my brain works is I have to get it out or else like it just like haunts me. So I thought that was the safe way to put it out.
We have not watched that show yet. We want to, but it's like very intense and our lives right now are intense. And so we're like trying to like watch Platonic, you know, which is like less intense and funny, but also like enough about like people who have kids. That you're like, okay, I can relate to this in a deep way because I also have kids. Thank God I don't have three. Although that's beautiful too. But
don't offend all those three children listeners
No, that's great. I mean, I secretly would like to have more children. It's just not going to happen me. But yeah, I mean, we have one bathroom in our house. And so like, and I don't know if you've seen that show, but there's like a whole scene about them, like one bathroom for five people and how they share it in the morning. And it's like, holy shit. I have to figure out another bathroom for my house. I gotta like build it. I can't live this. That is not gonna happen for me.
It is the main reason why we moved. I could have lived in a one bedroom with two children and my husband and my dog, but Sean needed a second bathroom. It was all he talked about for years. The
so
need
important.
For that.
Well, let's hear about your movie. How's that going? Any updates on Best Friends Forever?
I think I mentioned that another company reached out. And I had a phone call with them and it went really well. And, you know, I think what I'm trying to grapple with is how much am I willing to give away to an entity in order to make a movie happen? Right. And there's the early conversations where you say, I'm flexible. And they say, we're flexible, too. And, you know, you're doing the flirtation, you're doing the dance. And it's like when it comes down to it, I might not be able to do a theatrical run with this film. When it comes down to it, I might have to work with an entire crew from Georgia, which would not be the end of the world, you know, but you're just kind of thinking, where's my line? I don't know where my line is because I think you spend so many years trying to get a film off the ground that the line just goes lower and lower the longer you wait because you just want to make your movie so badly. Mm. So that's where I am, is waiting to see where the line is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my perspective is like for my first movie, I there was a line like I wasn't willing to like sell it, you know, off to somebody or like like risk the chance that I couldn't direct it or whatever. Like I had to make that first movie like on my own terms. And you've done it twice now. So you've had two movies that you've made on your own terms. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like as another filmmaker, like my advice to you would be like, there is no line. Just get your freaking movie made. Yeah. Like, you know, like just get another movie made and then make another movie and make another movie. And then you'll have the rest of your life to be precious about movies. But like this might be the one time that this movie is going to get made, you know, with X company. Right. Like, because it could take you another 5 years to raise the money on your own. And then like you might lose steam on it and get distracted and go on to another project, you know? And so it's like if you have a chance to make a movie,
just do
make the movie. But like I also realize that like it's not like a done deal. It's not like you have an offer and like everyone's lined up and it's like you have to give up so much for the chance to make your movie.
So, for like the,
so I understand.
Like the leap of faith that may occur, right? I love that you said that, but I also think, and I know you would also approach it this way, is just making sure the people who have attached themselves to this project up until this point feel respected and...
Right.
I don't even know if it's financial compensation, but some sort of recognition, because there's a way you put together a fully independent movie where people are giving you a lot of patience and time for free, and then you hand it off to someone else and you've kind of peed on all of that, right? So it's just making sure that the people who have attached themselves to this film are coming along too, or are okay with what we do next.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I know you have your whole, you know, Patreon that you've started, that you're collecting money and support from people. Yeah. So like, you don't want to dishonor that, you know, and you approach making this movie in a very independent, open way, which you also probably want to honor.
Yeah.
But, you know, just a small little story, which I may or may not have shared on the show before, but, you know, the last Black Man in San Francisco movie, they had funding for the movie. And then when Plan B came in, they had to give money back. They had to take money that they had from investors and give it back so that Plan B could be the full 100% investor in the movie. Wow. So like, that shit happens, you know, like they probably, I don't know how much they raised. I don't know the dollar amount was, but it was probably significant, like, you know, maybe half a million or a quarter million or something. And then like they had to return it, you know, so that Plan B could come in with their 2 million or whatever it was to fund the movie and make it happen. So
pretty interesting.
Things, shit happens, you know, like, shit, I mean, happens. I feel like this is a little bit more personal for you because you put yourself out there in a way with the movie. So I understand how it's probably harder to do that. But I'm just saying, like, there is a way. And like, I actually met one of the investors whose money got returned, and like, he wasn't pissed, you know, like he wasn't like angry at the director. He was like, I get it. Like, I would probably do the same thing, you know, if, you know, Brad Pitt's company came to me and wanted to give me money, like, probably take it, you know? So
yeah, it's just about communication. And just like you said, nothing's real. Nothing is for sure. I have a feeling, you know, my pessimism, this could be just a blip. But my mind also jumps to various permutations constantly of like, how do I, if X happens, what do I do? If Y happens, what do I do? So that's where I'm in right now, is just that mathematics stage of development. Mm-hmm. But what are you up to other than watching Platonic?
So I did a little writing this week, which was great. I mean, probably only a page, but like, after being sick for 2 weeks and like not doing anything, like, I feel like one page, like, I'm pretty proud of that.
Yes.
For a week.
Yes.
And then I reached out to the Vallejo film community. It's something I've been talking about doing since I moved here. And so I did a post on this Vallejo community group on Facebook, and I was like, hey, I'm a filmmaker. Where are y'all filmmakers at, basically, in a very long way? And then everyone was like, I got like 50 responses. Like, people were totally in, and like, for ranging from like people I've worked with before, like, who are professionals, like, who I didn't know lived in Vallejo, to like people who are like, you know, I'm a grandma, I want my kids to be actors. Like, let me know what's going on. Like kind of like complete like range of interest. So what I want to do is, I have one of my friends who worked on a bunch of my movies, but she's a special effects artist. She's lived out here and she has a studio out here. So she offered her space up. So what I'm going to try to do is organize some sort of community film meetup or something. Yes. That's like not anything crazy, not like once a month, like maybe like, you know, every other month or something like manageable, where it's not going to take up so much time. And just start to meet some of the people out here and start to build a little bit of a community and get to know like the people who want to make movies. So when I'm ready to make my next movie, that I have some more team members who live close by who want to help me make this movie in Vallejo. And I don't have to like, you know, I'm sure I'll still bring crew in that I've worked with before who live in the San Francisco or whatever. But like, at least I can build some team members here too, who like, it's not going to be like a 40-minute drive to get out here, you know?
Or like movies that you can edit too. Like, these filmmakers are making movies, and it's like, you could be, this is a great way for you to find potential collaborations as an editor in addition to as a director. So that's awesome.
Yeah, it was cool. It was a really, I was expecting to get some responses, but I was not expecting to get as many as I did. And like, you know, it's just really wonderful that community does exist here. It's just not really... We're not really organized right now, but maybe we will be soon.
Yeah.
Exactly. The other thing that's really exciting that you can do is to check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/mmihpodcast. That's where you can find all the back episodes of the show. I actually just got a message from one of our longtime listeners saying, where do I find the episodes? But they're posted on the main hero board of, like, if you're in Patreon, there's like a bunch of messages, and there's a pinned message with the link to the thing. So I will make sure to, like, let that person know exactly where to find it. But yeah, you can find it on your own pretty easily. Once you sign up for $2 or more a month, then you'll have access to all those episodes. Thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon. That's the way the show has been kept alive and keeps going. But without any more further delay, here is our producer Eric Tom's chat with Lena Headey.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
And I'm very excited to introduce you as writer-filmmaker. Now, I think I have kind of the path that you took in order to get to The Trap, but I want you to fill in some gaps for me. First off, just give me the elevator pitch for The Trap.
Someone asked me this the other night, and I gave the shittest pitch, which is maybe why it took so long. It's my version of a love story, and it's sort of an exploration into does unconditional love exist?
Mm-hmm. And how long did you shoot for?
I mean, we made the short film over five days, and then the feature we did in 3 6-day weeks.
Wow, okay. And if you can give me just a rough estimate of, like, what your budget was about. I know you're probably going for distribution and all that good stuff, so we can say under $100
million. Under $100
million. Okay, terrific. Okay, good to know. Now, I want to go back. So you did the free writing video, You Mean the World to Me, and I have to believe that that had the germ of this whole thing. Based on your lighting, the setting, you have some of your same actors as well. Stephen Waddington is in that. Go back to there. Did this film come out of an idea for that music video? Or did that music video have, like, an idea and you were like, I think I can expand that?
No. The idea for The Trap was conceived when I was pregnant and terrified of, like, being capable of loving something. I just thought, fuck, I don't really... There's a line in the film where a character says, I can see love, but I can't feel it. Mm-hmm. And I sort of felt like that for a really long time. I was like, I kind of can see what it is, and I see relationships and all that stuff. And I was like, I don't know if I'm really capable of genuinely doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was pregnant, and I was more terrified of being able to love a being. And then everyone was like, oh, you just experienced this unconditional love. Da, da, da. And I was like, does that really fucking exist, though, truly? The Freya Writings video we shot, so it took me years to get this off the ground. I showed it to lots of people, the sort of 30-minute script, and they were like, no one wants to see that. It's too dark, brother. And then I met the lovely Nicola, who's sitting behind me, who was like, why the fuck are you not making anything? And I was like, I don't know. And we made it, like, 2 weeks later. And then after that, we shot the Freya Writings video. I had a very different idea for that video, as I realized in my naivety in the music industry. You know, there are images, what's the word? Like, artists have an image, right? So you can't really fuck with that. And I came in with a very different idea for that video, and it was changed. It gets changed kind of on the day, almost.
Yeah.
And Maisie and Steve, I know, so, you know, they said they would come and do it. But no, there was no connection to that.
Really? Okay. And so how did getting into directing even start? Where did that begin? Was it the sort of thing that was kind of always buried, but then all of a sudden it's like around, like, the late 2010s, then opportunities start coming to you? Or did you actively go out and search them?
I've always wanted to do it since I started working, which is 30 years ago. And it's been, there's a curiosity, do you know what I mean? I used to love, like, the crew's always my people. Like, I love hanging with the crew. I nerd out about all that stuff. And, you know, you spend a lot of time, if you're not engaged as an actor, which happens sometimes on projects, you know, I find myself going, oh, I would do this shot, or I would do this. And I was like, why the fuck am I not doing it? Because it drives me insane.
Yeah.
Just because my brain works that way. My brain likes to be piled full, because then it's way calmer. And so it's been a desire for a long time. I said yesterday, I did a little talk yesterday, and I was like, you know, I think everyone thinks, because I did Game of Thrones, life's so easy and you just get everything you want. It's really not true.
It does seem to be in our industry, the two things people love to say is like, this person's going to be the next big thing, or this big person is done. They're over. So yeah, everyone's just waiting for you to fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, you know, back in the day, I would say to, you know, I'd be on a job and I'd think, oh, I'll just go to the producer and be like, I've written a script. So I really, you know, think I could direct. And it would just be pats on the head. You know, they go, oh, that's nice. Have you been to craft service? Like, that was it. Until I met Nicola, who was like, come on.
Yeah.
Let's fucking do it.
It seems with a lot of your projects, you like having the same people around you. Like when you did the Trap the Short, when you also did the music video, you had the same DP, you had the same editor. Do you, and you have a lot of the same actors as well that you surround yourself with. Do you like having a film family, or is it, are you just going from project to project and it just so happens there was kind of a through line with these?
Well, the Freya Rynings, it was not the same DP. Here's the thing, right? I've made two things. I've made a short film and I've just made a feature version. The people that come and do your short for no money deserve... I'm a very loyal human being, sometimes to a fault. But I think if someone's fucking great and they haven't had a chance, I love that. I love to be able to be like, I'm going to bring you in. I'm going to trust your talent. And we're going to collaborate and that's it. But I know no more than you. You know what I mean? Like DP John has been working for fucking years waiting for a thing and he's brilliant.
Yeah, he's done, I mean, a million music videos. If you look at his DP, like, if you look at his CV, like, and is, has done a ton of stuff. This was one of his first features, though, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, which he literally handheld the entire thing.
When you are preparing for your shoots, what kind of director are you? Are you, is it the sort of thing that you're preparing meticulously? Are you doing shot lists? Are you, like, pre, you know, doing pre-production in, like, Unreal Engine? Like, what's your directing kind of style?
yeah, I'm not a prepper.
Okay.
My preparation is sort of a visual preparation. I'll kind of search for imagery, pieces that I love. Then I talk to John. I'm like, we just have to have this visual moment here. Like that's where my head's at in prep. And so I just cover the walls in images. And then, you know, I'm working with Michelle Fairley, James and Stevie that I know really well. I know them well as human beings. And I know... I believe I know what makes them tick and what can push and all the buttons.
Yeah.
And also, people don't love rehearsal. Do you know what I mean? Unless you're doing Shakespeare on a big stage. I don't think it's hugely necessary on an emotional level. I certainly hate it as an actor. It's like, let's go through this. And you're like, why? You fucking want to find it on the day because you don't want to kill it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had no time either. So it was an easy... thing to swallow. I was like, it doesn't bother me. I know what I want to do. I have 100% belief in all of our ability to nail this. So,
well, then going to speaking to you as a writer, then. So, how much improvisation are you allowing? Are you just turning the camera on, like, we're just going to go? We'll almost like be a documentary style, or is it like, these are the scripts, this is the lines, we have to hit these things? Like, how serious are you about sticking to the script, being word perfect?
The other thing, John DP, I just call him John DP now. John's a massive prepper. So I know that frustrates me, and I frustrate him, which is quite funny. We've got that kind of relationship. He's like, oh, for fuck's sake, let's just do it. But script-wise, I'm not ever married to anything. I don't feel precious or ferociously protective of anything. I trust my actors to, you know, if they come to me and they're like, I just don't think I would. And I'm like, oh, you know, we did that a lot on this. It was like, you're absolutely fucking right. It's superfluous. You don't need it. And yeah, I'm pretty open to, it's how I would like to be treated as an actor. That's how I work as a director.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to see as well, so what was your writing process? Was it just you're going draft after draft after draft? Are you showing it to friends? Are you doing readings? What is your process there?
I'm pretty, like, I don't lock myself away in a cabin because I would go insane.
Sure.
I quite like noise and sort of, you know, the start. I always think, no, I need some peace. And it's like, no, nothing. I just sit there like this if there's peace.
Yeah.
Again, no. But I kind of knock it out pretty quickly. Sort of, you know, 10 pages, 15 pages, 5 pages, and it's... done. I can kind of fully get it done in a couple of weeks, and then I leave it and then revisit it.
And then, yeah, are you showing it to friends? Are you doing readings, or is it just like, look, I did it, that's what came out of me, and that's what we're gonna shoot?
This one, yes. I was very, I've wanted to do this for so long, and with these actors, you know, and I had other opportunities. Occasionally people are like, well, if you put this actor in, I'm like, I don't want to do it with that actor, I want to do it with these actors.
Yeah.
And, you know, last October, Nicola was saying this the other day, we walked, I got married and we were all at the wedding, and I said, look, I think we just have to let the trap go. It's never going to get financed. Like, I'm going to have to just bury it and grieve. And Nicola was like, absolutely not. And we had no money last October, and now we have a full film. Yeah. So it's insane that that happened.
That is a really fast turnaround, I feel. So yeah, I've got a dozen questions. I'm trying to focus. I want to speak to your actors. I also want to speak to like kind of the road to making this. So how do you go from October, you've got no money, to all of a sudden now we have a feature film? Like, was it all independent financiers? Was it some sort of like crowdfunding? Was it just like you going to baking cookies and then selling those? What was the... What
no,
was,
but that, that's a good idea. That might be the next one. No, we found a group of very generous mates who kind of kicked us off. And then we got, you know, other indie funding.
Yeah.
And kind of pulled it together. And I mean, it was quick, wasn't it, Nick? It was like, I'd say a month of pre-preparation and then...
Wow.
And then she...
Now, I have to assume you've reached a level as an actor that many actors do not get to. You're a bankable star. I'm willing to bet at some point there was a conversation of like, why don't we rewrite the main character and we have you star in it, and then that will move money along. Was that ever on the table?
I mean, people asked that, but you know, that the whole point of this is that I can fully immerse myself in what gives me the greatest joy, which is being this way.
Yeah. So you're just being strictly behind the camera.
Yes.
And I want to talk to you about your actors. So you've worked with most everyone here, but I mean, you have some incredible actors. Stephen Waddington, you have Michelle Fairley, James Nelson Joyce. Now, you'd worked with a lot of them in the past, especially with a lot of the music videos and things like that. Had you already tacked them? Like, look, one day I'm going to get money for my film, and I'm going to put this person in, I'm going to put this person in. Because they are all just solid character actors, just like go-to. Like, I feel like you can put them in anything, and they would be absolutely amazing. What was your choice when it came to choosing these people?
Well, I wrote it with Michelle in mind, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I hung out with Michelle a lot. We're good mates, and... I just love, she's sort of an extraordinary human and also, as we all know, a wonderful actor.
Yeah.
But I just love watching her face. And I was like, I want to do something where I get to watch your face all the time.
Yeah.
And you're not on screen for 2 minutes, you're on screen the entire time. And so it was written for her. And then James, Stephen Graham, that also other brilliant actor. I was speaking to Stephen, I was like, you know, do you know anyone? And he said, I've got this great kid who, you know, is young and ferocious and, you know, from where Steve is from. And so I met James before we did the short, and I was like, this guy's, you know, extraordinary. And Stevie Wads, I've known for a billion years, mm-hmm. and he is just a solid, one of the greatest humans in the world. And Ian Hart, I've known for 400 years. So I called him, I was like, hey,
you look great for your age, I gotta say. 400, doing well.
I know, it's the oil of Olay. That was my campaign pitch. And so Ian, I was like, will you come and do, you know, 2 days? And he was like, yeah, all right. And Geraldine James also. So, you know, I just got really lucky and got the actors I really wanted. Mm-hmm. And they're all fucking brilliant and wonderful to work with.
Now, a lot of your career, not all of your career, certainly, like, you've done, I feel like, kind of everything when it comes to acting. A lot of the characters you've played have been very big or action-oriented. This is a very... It's a smaller film as far as the story goes. It's very intimate. There's very few characters, and it's very strong emotional punches. So at any point, was there an idea of just like, we should put a car chase in here, or we got to have something explode, or something along those lines?
Yeah.
Like, this is gonna look good on the poster if we have a big explosion and an alien.
Here's my thing, right?
Yeah.
I feel like those films are so easy to put down on paper, and they're easy to fund because they're going to make money, right?
Sure.
So the whole time you're wrestling going, do I fucking write that script? Which is, I feel like I can knock it out and just wing it.
Yeah.
But this means, this is such an homage to what I grew up doing as an actor in the early days in England. This is the films we used to make. I've got such a love for them. The Ken Loach, you know, I grew up on him.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched every fucking film he's made. And I love each and every one. Shane Meadows. There's a working class British film element that is in my blood. Mm. And, you know, it's like the Richard Curtis version of England sells very well. But this, to me, it's the film I wanted to make. And and we made it. And for that, just that alone gives me joy.
Now, have you, as you said, you've done, I mean, I don't feel like you're giving yourself enough credit. You've directed a bit now for a while. I mean, like the last 5-6 years, you've had quite a few different projects. has this lit the fire underneath you? Like, is there...
There's always been a fire. Yeah. It's just, I'm, you know, it's like you do the short and you're like, someone's going to give me money. And then turns out 5 years later, you're still going, anyone?
Yeah.
So it doesn't ever go how you think it's going to go. It's fucking hard making films.
Yes. I have a podcast called Making Movies Is Hard.
Yeah. No,
yeah, yeah.
but, you know, I've written a new piece, which is kind of wildly audacious and ambitious mm-hmm. and huge. And yeah. so I was like, if I make this film that is absolutely the most authentic thing I can do right now, mm-hmm. and I think making a small performance-driven film isn't the easiest thing to do because that you it's all out there to pick apart.
Like, sure.
There's no flashy moments. It just, you're asking the audience to be with these people.
Yeah.
And a lot of people may not, and some may really find connection. And so that, then to write something bigger, which requires a bigger budget, I'm hoping that, you know, someone will go, oh, it's clear you can make a film.
Yeah.
You can make a really small film, which isn't the easiest thing to do. So maybe you can do this too.
Yeah, it seems to be, we've talked to so many filmmakers over the years, and the old adage is absolutely true. It's like, whatever you're spending on production, you need to pretty much spend that on marketing as well, because it's terrific where you live in the internet age. You can press of a button, you can talk to anyone around the world. Having said that, you need an enormous microphone these days in mm-hmm. order to get to speak above the din. So that's kind of what I wondered as well. It's like, did you think of, at any time, was there like, we got to do something in order to really, like, just blow this out, in order to, like, really get this idea passed? But it sounds like the thing you were most excited about was, yeah, just, like, telling a small story about these very...
Well, also, you know, yes, and I know from the short, you know, Michelle and James and Stevie loved it. They loved every second, and they kept saying... They were all on board the entire 5 years.
Yeah.
I was like, just give me a little second. And then I was like, we're going to make it. No, we're not. Hang on. So it was just, but everybody, no one left the ship.
Yeah.
And I was also the same. I was like, these are the actors. This is it. And of course, there's no flashy, no. Why would there be in that story? You know what I mean?
I do have to say, too, I'm not downplaying the film. The film is incredible. It's really, really well done.
I totally get your question. It's like I saw a movie the other day that I'm not going to say the title of, and it's had really great notices, and I was like, God, I bet this is gonna be amazing. And the end shot of the film, I was like, that's why they wrote the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because this end shot was epic for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
But to me, that was the whole film. I was waiting for this kind of moment.
Yeah. And yeah, you certainly
remember. And everything that went before, I was like, I couldn't give a shit.
Yeah. Okay, now we're down to our final six questions. These are kind of rapid fire questions.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's right. These are the tough ones.
Shit.
Yeah, you should be nervous.
I'm terrified.
What is the first film that you ever made? And this could be like a student film, something you made with like kids in the backyard. And how do you feel about that today?
I made a little film in LA called The Sophisticates. And then I wrote a feature film thinking, again, someone will give me money. No sure. one did.
Please take us through The Sophisticates, because the way that Tina Thor is laughing. That's your publicist. I have to assume that this was...
I just moved to LA and I was kind of like, anyone? You know, it was like off the street, people trying to make a movie with... And so it was a sort of comedy about an agency that sent out lookalikes to people that wanted to perform scenes from movies in their own, in their suburban homes.
Okay.
That's it. Never made it.
How do you feel about that film?
I kind of love it. It's weird. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like those first projects always have a special place in your
heart. Yes. I still want to make it. I think it's funny.
There you go. Everybody listening to this, if you can just... What, 3 million?
Five.
Five million?
Call it five.
You can find that in the couch cushion.
Right.
What is some of the best filmmaking advice that you've ever gotten?
I don't think I've had any of it, because this is my first film, really, that anyone's ever taken any notice of. So, you know, I sent it to a director that I admire so much, and I sent it to him, and I was like, I just want your opinion. And he sent me the loveliest note back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's one of the biggest influences in terms of, you know, working with a director as an actor and thinking, that's how you fucking do it.
Who was this?
Mark Mylod.
Oh, okay.
And he's just dreamy and, as we know, excellent at what he does, but he fucking treats and talks to people as you should. He doesn't take a director hat and think, I can fucking rule the world. You know.
Yeah.
And he creates magic and brings magic out of people.
And so what kind of advice was he giving you, or was he just...
I think just hanging with him, you kind of, you know, it's like osmosis. You kind of take it in.
Yeah, yeah, you're just seeing the tricks right there in front of you.
Well, there's no tricks. That's the joy to him. Mm-hmm. You just, he's curious and interested and invested and fucking loves actors. And that's a really weird rarity in directors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. I have a couple of friends who describe, it's like there are certain times that certain directors, like, this is the camera, we take the camera out of the box. This is the actor, we take the actor out of the box. And like, they're kind of exactly the same.
Yes.
No, you can treat them a little bit differently.
Yeah. Yeah. See? Oh, that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get into that one.
We'll call it Naming Names.
we're gonna get in trouble. This is our first interview and we're going to get in trouble already. All right, fair enough. What is the worst filmmaking advice that you have ever...
Well, again, it's just observational. You know, I 30 years I've been watching and learning and feeling. I know how it feels to stand there and be vulnerable. And if you're not allowed to be vulnerable, or you don't feel safe to be vulnerable, or it's not your day to be vulnerable, you need somebody to hold space for you to be all those things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't give a shit. It's like you say, taking somebody out of a box, treating them kind of like they have one thing to do and that's it. Mm-hmm. And then you go home. You know what I mean? And actors are complicated.
Yes. Sensitive, complicated people who have to build certain walls around themselves because otherwise just the world is too crushing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, like most of us, truly. But yeah.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker? Is there a certain...
To make fuckloads of money for myself.
I knew it. You're a sellout.
Yes.
Right from the start. Good for you.
That's what I'm here for.
Do you have like a slate of like, these are the other 16 films I want to make?
Or
it's like, I just want to make these two films. And, like, these are the ones that are really personal.
No, I have like 4 million, which is really... My brain is not quiet.
So your brain is just on fire all the time.
Yes. Okay. I was saying this yesterday. I see stories in every fucking minute of the day. And then I thread the story into a long story and then I have to write it down.
I'm also one of those people that have like, I have a million, like my notes app. I just will have like a line of just like, turkey that grows to 50 feet. Like, what the hell did that mean?
Who doesn't want that?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. 50 foot turkey, it's going to be right up there. We'll double bill with the sophisticates. It'll be fantastic.
I feel a franchise.
Watch out, Marvel. If you could go back in time and give yourself a piece of advice prior to making The Trap.
Yes.
What would it be?
I think fight more in terms of, you know, this is my first experience and I didn't feel internal pressure because I knew what I could achieve and I knew I could do it in the time given and with what we had and the people we had. I had no doubts. I was just fucking excited to get out and get it done.
Yeah.
But I think external pressure, you know, production-wise, of like moving on and dropping this and doing, you know, and some, and me going, fuck yeah, okay, we can cut that. I think I would have more conviction to say, absolutely not, we need to do this.
Yeah.
So I guess I learned that kind of. I've never been in production meetings and all that stuff before, so that was a big. I mean, I find them fucking boring, but that was a big learning curve.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Excel spreadsheets.
I think I was so thankful to be able to make it that I was like, absolutely. You know, I stuck to my guns when I knew it truly mattered in terms of like emotional meat. Mm-hmm. But I think locations wise, all that kind of stuff, you know, I was willing to give up lots and lots and lots just to be able to do it.
Well, a little side tangent there. You had said that when it came to pre-production, you don't have a lot of pre-production. Like, you know, it sounds like, you know, you leave that to your DOP.
I mean, no, he's just, John is, you know, wants 50 shot lists. And I'm like, well, let's wait because there may be a moment that swings us somewhere, you know, so that drives him nuts. So we compromise.
Well, when you're on set, though, and like, it's like, okay, we have to cut this. We're not doing this. How good are you at keeping track? It's just like, okay, so if we're not doing this storyline, then we don't need to worry about this. Like,
No, it's pretty easy. Like I said, my brain's weirdly happier having 50 challenges in it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's the thing of continuity and all that stuff. When someone's like, oh, it's not going to work. I'm like, it is. even though conventionally it might seem like it might not, I can see what is going to go. That's the other thing. I don't like to torture people with 75 fucking takes. I'm like, I know what I want. You gave it to me. Let's do the other thing.
So you're more Clint Eastwood than you are David Fincher.
I believe so.
Yeah. final question. Is making movies hard?
The run-up to making a movie is hard. Mm-hmm. The making of the movie is fucking deep, creative, torturous pleasure.
That's supposed to be their final, and then it's this big, you know, denouement and all that stuff. But now I've got a ton more questions. So, like, are you more, like, when you're on set, when you're in production, like, is that just when you're the most comfortable, or is it just, like, sitting in the editing bay and be like, okay, cool, let's take the clay and, like, really, really make the film now?
The making of is, I don't think I've experienced joy like that.
Yeah.
Ever. I fucking love it. I love everybody. I love it. Yeah. I love when I see someone do a fucking great job and they know it. Mm-hmm. I love the collective, collaborative nature of it. I mm-hmm. love seeing actors walk out feeling fucking great at the end of the day. And I like solving problems. I like running, solving problems and creatively. The edit, I hate until the last day.
Mm-hmm. We are all...
But soul destroying.
Everyone in this production, we're all filmmakers as well.
Yeah.
And so I'm just finished my first feature.
Congrats.
Thank you very much. And I did star in mine. I've been SAG for 16 years, and watching myself on screen, it was like I could get about 20 seconds and then I would go scream into a pillow and then come back. But yeah, no,
I know that one.
And I feel like when it comes to the edit, you always have those moments where you remember the day and you remember yourself saying like, oh, we should move on. And then you're like, oh, why didn't we go back and do that other, like the reverse the camera or something like
that. I mean, there's all that too, but there's also when you, like a first assembly, I saw it and I literally rang Nicola and I said, I'm fucking done. I hate it. Shit. It's fucking shit. My husband was like, I'm not going to talk to you for 24 hours mm-hmm. because I can see what's happening. And I sat in bed and I cried like a lunatic. I mean, I literally sobbed and was like, that's the thing I thought I could do. I can't do. I fucking can't. I rang everyone and I was like, I'm fucking done. What the fuck? 30 yeah. years of me thinking this was my destiny.
Yeah.
And I fucking lied to myself. And then a day later, we had the film we have now, and I'm really proud of it. But that's it's terrific. Bizarre. That fucking process is horrendous.
Yeah. I think it's Scorsese that says, like, if you look at your rough cut and it doesn't make you nauseous, then you didn't do something right.
Yeah, everyone kept sending me quotes from my address going, no, you're fine, listen, you're meant to feel this way. And I was like, it does not feel good.
It does not. It does not. No. But being at the Austin Film Festival, and you finish your film, and now you're able to screen it, what is a good Instagram to follow you?
Oh, I am Lena Headey.
Okay. So is this just your first stop with the festival run? Are there going to be more? What is the plan for you as far as like shouting this out, trying to get that microphone to point to you in this film?
I don't know. We're still waiting. We've got some, you know how that is. There's a long, long process. But no, this is our first ever sharing of the film at the Austin Film Fest. And we're just thrilled to be here.
Do you love Making Movies Is Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show. So since Eric was the one who had the interview with Lena Headey, we thought we'd bring Eric in to talk about his conversation. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, thanks, guys.
What can you tell us about your chat? Oh, you want to say other things first? Okay.
First off, I want to give a big shout out to the Austin Film Festival for setting this up, and also to the Omni Hotel for setting this up with a really sweet podcasting room. We were in there the whole day. It was fantastic. I had a really good time.
So, Eric, what can you tell us about your chat with Lena?
I had heard going into this conversation that Lena is actually a bad interview, and I found that to be 100% true. Now, don't confuse me. She is a very nice person. She is lovely. She was on time. She was complimentary. She invited us to the screening of her film. But she on our show, I explained, like, we're filmmakers. We're making this podcast for filmmakers. We like to know things about, like, the nitty-gritty. We want to know about your production schedule. We want to know about, like, your path to getting funding. I get the impression from her that she is an artsy person and kind of goes with the flow of the universe, if you will. And so when I tried to nail her down on certain things, like, you know, how many days did you shoot? What did you prepare in order to give to your DP? She really didn't have a lot of great answers. She would just say, like, these kind of blanket statements, like, oh, I'm not very good at preparing things. And like, oh, and John, the DP, was great. And it was like, oh, okay. But if you could give us some real concrete advice, like, how did you get from, like, she even mentioned at one point, like, oh, last October we had no money, and then now this October we're premiering the film. I was like, oh, cool, then great, would you talk a little bit more about how you raised the money? And not really, she didn't do too good a job of explaining any of that. So, but I mean, having said that, she was a very lovely person. She was very nice, and I had a good time talking to her. She's incredibly charismatic and invited me to the screening of her film and asked me to actually take a second and stop by and say hello. So, nice lady. Not great on details, though.
Did you get to talk about Judge Dredd at all? Or was that not? Did that come up?
I did get to mention Judge Dredd. And I kind of alluded to the fact that maybe now, since she's a director, she could direct Judge Dredd too. Since her character, spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen Judge Dredd, which absolutely you should go see Judge. It's just called Dredd. I'm sorry.
Dredd. Yeah, we're being very bad nerds here. Just Dredd.
Yeah, it's just called Dredd. But her character dies at the very end of the film. And it was like, great, then you can go ahead and spearhead Dredd 2. And I don't think that's going to happen. But that is an amazing film. If anyone hasn't seen Dredd, go check it out.
Oh, it's so good. Amazing.
So, Alric, I have a question. Now that Eric's gone, thank God. I have a question. I have a question from Eric for you for our segment called The Game. So for those of you who don't know what The Game is, it is a homespun, handmade segment from Eric Thoms, our producer, who puts forth a theoretical indie film quandary, problem, quagmire for us to solve on the spot blind. And this is the first time Alric is hearing this game question. So you're a week into shooting a road trip movie that you have been hired to direct. One of the gimmicks of the film is that the two main characters are driving a muscle car from the 70s. After a week of shooting, smoke starts pouring out of the car and the mechanics take a look. The car's engine has major problems. Paying to replace the motor would cost thousands of dollars and take nearly a month to wait for parts. You've shot everything else in the script that doesn't require the car, but now you have to shoot the remaining scenes where the car is highlighted, including a chase sequence. The car can drive but only reach a top speed of 15 miles per hour. Do you, A, use camera tricks and possibly green screen to make it seem like the car is driving fast? B, rewrite the script, trying your best to make the script a road movie but without the car? C, shut down production, wait a month, and raise money to fix the car? D, other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Well, that's a good one. So I have all the car stuff to shoot, including the action sequence with the car. That's all that's left of the movie. Everything else has been shot, basically.
Only things with the car, yeah, are left to be shot.
Huh, interesting. Yeah. Again, it kind of depends on like what the plan was with the car, but I might just assume that it was for it to be driven by a precision car driver and for it to be driven fast and everything. So that would be tough. What would I do? I think I'd probably shoot all the stuff with the actors in the car, because that can be relatively, like, that can be cheated in many different ways. Like, we could get a process trailer for probably not that much more money and then put the car on the process trailer and then just do it that way. Or if we couldn't afford the process trailer, we could do the green screen approach, which I know a lot of people have done or do, where you just like put a green screen around the car and then the car isn't moving, but you just shoot, you know, the actors in the car, then you can get plates later, you know, for it. So I'd probably do either one of those for the actor stuff. And then I'd have to assess and see, like, you know, do we just do a whole second unit for the, you know, all the car stuff later? Like, that probably makes the most sense, is just to raise the money, fix the car, you know, do it that way rather than trying to like jerry rig an action sequence with a car that doesn't work. Like, it's going to be hard enough to shoot the action sequence anyways. Like, what you probably would end up doing is like taking the time that you had, like, it's an indie movie, right? Like, it's not going to be a big schedule. So take the time that you had set for the action sequences. Use that to like make the rest of the movie that you can do with the actors in the cars and those like talking scenes.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, call it a wrap and then raise money, you know, whether it's crowdfunding or equity investment, like edit the movie, you use the movie to raise money and everything, use the footage. And then, yeah, at a later date, shoot the action sequence. I think that's like the best way, because if you try to like the action sequence is going to be really hard anyways. And if you try to like rush it or really cheat it in a way, like, it's just going to be bonkers bad. And like, you know, like action sequences, especially car chases, like, how many car chases have we seen? We've seen 1 million, trillion, thousand, billion, zillion, gazillion car chases. So like, you need your car chase to be really special and interesting in order for it to like even be worthy of existing. Just having a car chase to have a car chase is like boring and lame, you know? So, I mean, maybe you'd already have thought about like a way to do the car chase in an interesting way where you don't actually even need to see the car, where it's all like character's perspective looking out of the car while you're driving, so it's like super intense and more like a like Ronin style where they have like the camera at the front of the car like looking out as they drive. Like maybe there's like some way you could have cheated that way, but like I don't know. I would probably just still, even given all that, I would probably just like just take the time to replan it out and make it really special and do it later.
I think there's, I totally agree with what you're saying, but I think there's one addendum which doesn't take into account how interesting car people are. Car people are super interesting.
Mm.
And I, not that I'm an expert, but I did run a campaign at my last job having to do with Broncos, and I got to know a lot of people who liked Broncos, and they were so incredibly passionate about Broncos. So that's just like one subset, right? And it's like, I bet you could crowdsource a replacement car that's very similar from someone and then bring on an extra team with the time you have left. Like, I think there's a world. I know that I, when I was looking to get people to attend a screening for a fictional character named John Bronco, played by Walton Goggins, it wasn't that hard because there were many, many Facebook groups devoted to very specific types of cars, vintage cars. There's car parades. There, you know, there's like all these restorationists. And I know you'd have to convince these people. I'm not saying it's like easy to convince someone to let them use your car in a film, but I can say that that sounds pretty like a sweet deal to someone who loves their car for their car to be in a movie. And so I think that my D would be to try to find a replacement car that would be a double for this car. And I don't know why it wasn't mentioned, but maybe it's just such a specific car that you couldn't find a double for it.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I mean, I feel like my experience with picture cars is that like it's either really expensive or you get people who like it's their own baby, right? And so they're super protective.
They need to be on set. They have to okay everything that is going to happen to this car. Totally.
And I'm assuming with an action sequence, like there's going to be some sort of damage involved. You know, like it's not going to be like just completely clean. So like there would have to be some, but there's probably a way that you could use the busted car that you were going to destroy or you were going to damage and like use that for the damage shots and then, you know, use a new car for like the other.
It's not an easy problem to solve, but I just think I think there would be a way. These car people, they're a passionate culture, right? So I think you could find different doubles, but I do agree. Yeah. You use the one that you had for the most risky scenarios because it's already insured. I assume if you have a proper indie film production and they already okay using it. So.
Yeah, I mean, I did do a little bit of this on a movie recently where
'70s
cars. Yeah, that's so right. it was really fun to meet all these people who are like super passionate about their cars and like we did get like this guy had this old taxi, like the '70s taxi, and like it was like half painted, and then I think for like nothing he like let us have it, but then we painted it and redid it and made it super nice, and then we gave it back to him. So we like basically restored his car like to be used in the movie, and then we're like, hey, well, here you go. Here's a restored taxi for you.
Nice.
So that's pretty cool.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like that definitely, I like your answer. I think that's definitely another good solution.
Yeah. Well, let's hear if people agree with us. You could send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. We want to shout out the International Screenwriters Association, which is an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through the programs they offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals, consultation courses, contests, and they have a top 25 writers list. Head on over to networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Lena Ahidi for coming on the show. Thanks to Austin Film Festival for having us back this year. To the Omni Hotel for hosting us in their podcast room for the second time. Thanks to Tina Thor from TMT Entertainment for setting this up. Our editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing the editing. Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you next week.
Liz is like, thumbs up. We've got it. Let's move on to the next one.
Okay, I'm going to stop this.